everyone. In today's episode, we're going to talk about HRT and uterine lining. I'm Dr. Davidson from Progress Your Health.
And I'm Dr. Mackey from Progress Your Health. So we've been getting, with our channel, you know, still sort of growing, I think it's barely 6 months old, but we've been actually getting quite a few comments. We appreciate all the comments. Please, you know, keep writing them. But today we're going to take three of them and we're going to sort of combine them because they relatively, you know, kind of all revolve around that same topic.
Yeah, I think they're just really more, which we love the comments, but a little bit more about clarification about, you know, using hormone replacement therapy and then having a thickened uterine lining. So here, let me start the first one.
Yeah, you always read it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's see. So this one is from Sheila. So how can you tell if the lining is not building up in the uterus when on static hormone replacement? Forgive me if I missed this in the video. So that was one of the questions that we had.
Let's just start with that
one.
Okay,
let's start with that one.
We're not going to read three out in the row. We're going to do one at a time.
Got it.
Now that's exactly, you didn't miss it in the video. It's probably going to be in a lot more videos moving forward because at the end of the day, what the question she's asking is probably, at least in my opinion, and I know in yours, are probably the most important issue when it comes to hormone replacement. Our number one rule is safety first. So it has to be one of those things that is front of mind, because I'm going to turn this, I sort of know the answer to this question, but I'm going to turn it back to you. How can you tell if the lining is building up?
Well, number one, if you're having some spotting, right? If you're having some spotting, some discharge that's, you know, red, or if you're having a period, that would be number one.
Yeah. Well, now that's sort of obvious in a way, but where I think that question sort of gets complicated. If a woman's on a static dose and she doesn't have any of those things, then what do you do?
Well, you know, I do think doing a transvaginal ultrasound, which is super easy and super simple, is a good idea to do every once in a while. So in some cases, when you're working with a patient, or let's say you're feeling, because, you know, we know how it feels to have cramps. You know, maybe you don't.
Of course I don't. Yeah, yeah. That's why I default to you all the time, because I'm a man sort of navigating in a woman's world, right? You know, there's some things that I know just from experience, but there's also a piece of that. And I, you know, I'm very aware that there's a lot of things that I don't understand fundamentally is what women are dealing with on a monthly basis. I try to understand it. I get a lot of feedback and I've learned a lot about that, but I don't truly understand what a woman is experiencing, obviously, on a monthly basis. So I think her question, like, no, you're getting into the solutions on how you figure that out. But my question to drill down on what she's asking is if she's on hormone replacement and she's not having any bleeding or discharge, how do you know if that lining is thickening or not?
You really don't.
Yeah, yeah. There's no way to know. Mm-hmm. That is, now the way we do it, right, we feel pretty confident that the way we prescribe hormones, again, safety first, it actually protects them from that over time. Because if you don't have what you said a minute ago, if they do have bleeding or discharge or anything, it's sort of obvious.
Yeah, and at that point too, I mean, that does happen when you're doing hormone replacement, especially when you're very, you know, in the beginning when you're just starting it, sometimes, you know, the uterine lining thickens up, and I call it kind of like cleaning house. So there might be a little, you know, bleeding, but then you want to secure that, make sure the lining isn't getting too thick, and we'll talk a little bit more about transvaginal ultrasounds in a second, but then you want to just make sure you alter the hormone dosing so you don't get bleeding. But of course, before you get to any kind of bleeding, you want to make sure that that's not going to happen. So it does come down to the hormone doses, which we can also talk about. And then, like I was mentioning too, is if I have a patient and she'll say, you know, I feel just kind of bloated, you know, or kind of crampy, or just like I feel like this sort of tightening like I used to when I would have a period, that's also a really good indication to say, hey, let's do a transvaginal ultrasound. Now, we know the area down south is small. You know, you've got your, you know, you got your bladder, you got, if you still have your, you know, your uterus, you have the vaginal vault, you have your, you know, you have your ovaries, you have your whole digestive system there and the colon. There's a lot going on down there.
Yeah. So there's not a lot of space.
There's not a lot of space. It's a small area. So sometimes, you know, constipation can make it feel like cramping. But a lot of times women, because we, you know, getting up to menopause, a lot of women know what a cramping feels like because they've had many periods over their life. is they would know, like, it just feels like cramping. And that's your cue to say, you know what, let's just do something super easy and let's do a transvaginal ultrasound. Yeah,
and I know there's, we've talked about this before too, that if you're concerned, any woman that is on hormone replacement and you're concerned about that in any way whatsoever, it does not hurt to just, like you said, just to go get a transvaginal ultrasound. Now, I just had this conversation. We're going to use this as an impetus for these other two questions. So I just had a patient the other day that her husband went to another clinic, did some testing, you know, took some supplementation, had a really good response. So she decided that she wanted to, you know, go through the same testing. She did a little bit more testing. She's right on that cusp of going from, she's 52, she's right on that cusp of, you know, perimenopause and going into menopause, right? So 52, still having a period as of, you know, a few months ago, was put on a troche, a 2 milligram troche of estradiol plus a few other things in
which
there.
Which is kind of, for those that don't know what a troche is, it's basically sort of like a sublingual insert that you put in the inside of the cheek or under the tongue, and it has, you know, estrogen, estriol, estradiol. It can also have progesterone in there. You can put anything you want in there, really. But it, there is some element of oral to that because, you know, you can't sublingual everything. You know, it does dissolve and then you swallow it, so.
Now, so back to so the dates really don't matter, but just in relationship to real time, she had some blood work done from them in November. Her estradiol level was less than 5. Okay, so not very much. Her FSH was relatively pretty high, like 50 something, 54. And now she's on the troche for basically 2 months. 2 milligram troche, sublingual, and her estradiol was 270. And I talked to her, she started bleeding, which she described to me as a pretty much a full-blown period, 2 months after she had started the hormones and her blood level. You know, so we've talked, of course, her blood level, the bleeding gave us some information, the blood level gave us some information, right? So of course, I told her to go back to, you know, her other practitioner and they need to make some adjustments there. So in that case, it was sort of obvious because, you know, something needs to change in her situation because she had the clue that she's bleeding, but it was, you know, she'd only been on it for a couple of months.
And then just to kind of further go into that, so she's in kind of that sort of gray limbo land area where you're not quite in perimenopause anymore because you're sliding out of that and you're going into menopause, but you're not quite full in menopause. So putting somebody on some estrogen, you always want to make sure, and maybe this is something to address too, if they have a uterus, of course, you want to make sure that they're on a good amount of progesterone to balance that estrogen because estrogen likes to grow the uterine lining, specifically estradiol. Estriol, not so much, but right. Estradiol loves, there's certain receptors, beta or alpha or something in the uterine lining that estradiol stimulates to create that lining to thicken. But the progesterone helps offset that. So it sounds like for your client, your patient, that perhaps with the troche, there was too much estradiol in there and maybe she wasn't on sufficient progesterone.
Well, see, that's what we're trying to decide. What is her next course of action? Mm-hmm. Now, granted, she's only probably less than 6 months out of her own last period, mm-hmm. right? So you know as well as I do, that's going to make it more susceptible. Is the period she's has, this is the question, is the period she's having right now, is it her own period? She's just going to have it naturally, regardless of the hormones? Or did the hormones create that period? I think it was the hormones that did that because her blood level was 270.
Was she bleeding when she had the blood work done? Not sure.
I think she had the blood work done and she bled right after that. I think the blood work, let's say, was done on a Wednesday and she started bleeding like a couple days after on a Friday. Because it was almost like perfect timing between when she started bleeding and when we had our consult.
So if she was having a bleed, so let's say she did her blood work on one day, let's say Thursday, and then she started bleeding Friday or Saturday, just a few days short, and her blood work reflected an estradiol level of 200, then it's definitely coming
270.
It's definitely coming from that troche that she's taking exogenously, right. Because if it were really truly her period, which is why when someone's cycling, you have to be careful when you test their blood work, because on your period, your estrogen is low. It will be less than five.
Yeah,
it would
right.
be less than 25. So the fact that she...
It wouldn't be 270 while she's bleeding.
Yeah, so if she got totally a bleed right. a couple of days later...
But her FSH level went from like 60 54 something down to like 4 point something.
Oh, yeah. So she's, right. It's just too much of the hormones. And she's kind of in that little, like I said, limbo land. That FSH will bounce around a little bit until the ovaries decide that they're fully retired. Now, one thing we may not have to maybe some new viewers here and listeners mentioned that, well, who cares about having bleeding? Like, who cares about the thickening lining?
Yeah. Right. In the short term, not a big deal, but long term.
Some people don't realize having a thickened, endometrial lining, a thickened uterine lining can be a risk for cancer of the uterus.
Eventually. So that's not in the short term, but eventually.
But that's the thing we want to prevent, because that is easily preventable when you balance those hormones. So.
What her question is, how can you tell if the lining is not building up in the uterus when on static hormone replacement? That is sort of the, as we say, safety first. As you said a few minutes ago, you never give a woman unopposed estrogen, because at some point she's going to start bleeding.
Yeah.
Okay, so in my patient example, her estrogen dose either needs to go down, and or her progesterone level needs to go up.
Was she on progesterone? Did the practitioner give her progesterone?
It was in the troche.
So that's do you know how much?
I want to say, I should know. It's in my notes. I want to say it was 100. It might have been 150. I'm pretty sure it was 100.
So, one of the better ways to really protect the uterus, and there's a lot of information out there from practitioners, from AI, from Google, but that'll tell you different than what I'm going to tell you. But what I do know, even from, what I do truly believe in.
And I think they should listen to you.
Is the oral progesterone, not a troche sublingual, not a cream. The oral progesterone has a lot more protection to that uterus to keep that lining to thicken up, from not thickening up. So the sublinguals, the creams I've seen the lining thicken up. I've seen that.
Now, you and I have kind of hashed this out a bunch of different ways, but that's why safety is the most important part, which is the question that has probably come up the most as we started this channel is about the, and rightly so, because no woman wants to be taking hormones for 10 years. Though my patient's 52, she can be on hormones for a long time. And when there is, it's almost like a silent problem that nobody knows. If there's no bleeding, you have no idea if that lining is thickening or not, unless you do that transvaginal ultrasound on a regular basis, which I think, brings me back to something else about that same patient. But I think that's pretty simple to do.
No, and also too, for Sheila here mentioning this, is doing the blood work. Like if I got somebody's blood work back and they're doing a static dosing and their estradiol level is 270, that is too high for a static level.
Too high.
That's too high. You just know whether they're bleeding or they're not bleeding, this is a risk to start to thicken up that lining, that you just back down the dose.
Yeah.
And then also too, just on a completely side note, if a woman has an estradiol, she's on static dosing, in menopause, and has an estradiol of 270, she's not going to feel great. Too much of a good thing is not a good thing.
Well, I disagree. She feels pretty good.
Well, I bet she does, but long term, she's going to probably get a little puffy, a little munchy, a little PMS-y. That's why we always talk about if you're going to have those higher levels, is you want to cycle it.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Well, she's only been on for a little while. Eventually, that number will sort of catch up with her because of what you just said. But in the short term, she does feel pretty good. I said there's going to be a trade-off here because we have to lower your dose, but now you're going to not feel as good because your estrogen level won't be as high, but it's going to prevent you from bleeding in the future.
Oh, did you end up changing that? Or?
Well, I sent her back to the doctor that put her on the troche because the last time I talked to her, which was a few months ago, she was still bleeding. She was having a regular period. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I told her, you're not really technically an estrogen candidate yet because you're not fully crossed over where either your period is irregular, meaning sporadic. She's not having, because up to that point, she was having a regular, consistent period. Can't really put estrogen on top of estrogen at that point. So a few months had went by. We hadn't had a consult. That's why she went to this other practitioner, just because her husband had such a good experience. It's fine. Happens all the time. And of course, she's 52. So just from an age perspective, and when they tested her blood, to their credit, her estradiol level was less than 5 and her FSH was really high. So on paper, she looked like a candidate. And even from my standpoint, I would have probably put her on some form of estrogen at the same time back in November. Like as well as I do, that anytime you're starting a dose like that, bleeding in the short term is very common. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that you need to run out and get a trans. She does not need to go out and get a transvaginal ultrasound right now because she said it was a full-blown period. The lining sloughed off. So now it's like she's starting over from scratch. But the dosing needs to change in some capacity. We haven't, that's the part where we're still in limbo. I sent her back to get some clarification and a solution. I know what the solution should be. You and I talked about
She'll be
it.
Back.
You and I know what the solution should be. I'm sort of curious to see what their solution is based on her current problem.
Sure.
You know, so we'll get into that on another one. We'll follow that back up because there's,
well, that'd be cool.
Well, there's a few ways on that particular situation and how that can be handled. Mm-hmm. How would you and I handle it? You and I would handle it relatively the same way. How would somebody else handle that? And which one is the right answer? Which one is going to be both best for the patient, but also keep them safe at the same time?
Absolutely. And like I'd mentioned, you know, doing a transvaginal ultrasound, she doesn't need one right now. She just needs to have an adjustment of the hormones. But a transvaginal ultrasound is super easy to do. It's very invasive or not invasive, like, you know, something else. You just basically, there's a wand up the vaginal vault, and then it looks at the ovaries if you still have them. It looks at the uterus. You can find fibroids. You can find thickening of the lining. There's a lot of things you can find on a transvaginal ultrasound. So I do think at some point, you know, if somebody is concerned, it's really easy to just send them out for one.
Now, let's talk about that for a second, because that's come up a couple of times too. What is your thoughts on and this is a whole separate topic, but I'm going to throw it in here anyways. So what is your, and this might even be a clip that we put up on Instagram or YouTube short, because it's a sort of the same, but a different topic. So what is your opinion of women getting an annual exam every year?
You mean like a pap smear or
because women don't really understand some of the back end stuff, right? They just, they're told to go into their gynecologist and they have their annual. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what does that mean? And what do you think it should mean?
Well, you know, back when I was younger, it was you go in every year and you have a pap smear and they take the cells off of the cervix and they test them to see if there's any change in the cytology to see if you might be at risk for cervical cancer. Then later we found out, you know, maybe in the early 2000s, that cervical cancer really was from HPV. Getting an HPV infection, there's so many different strains of HPV, but there's like a few different ones that are specific for cervical cancer. So then it turned into going in for your annual exam to get those cells and test them for those special HPV.
And it was more considered to be like an STI at that point.
Yeah, exactly.
Or classified as an STI.
And what we know is we can test women's cells on that cervix to find out if they have HPV, but you can't test the men. So it was determined that anytime you had a new sexual partner or you were intimate where you could catch HPV from a man, because you can't test it on the fellas, is then you come in, you have that exam. So now they're saying that you don't necessarily need to have a pap smear to check for cervical cells changes or the risk of cervical cancer, unless you've had maybe a new partner, then you would, or if, you know, having a vaginal exam and a speculum and looking at the tissues, if you feel like you have a yeast infection or bacterial vaginosis or an STI, of course, then you would want to have an exam on that. But now, you know, things have changed a little bit. So sure, if I have a patient that's maybe, let's say they're not on any hormones, they've been married, you know, they're already postmenopausal and they're monogamous,
You and I have been together for 24 years.
We certainly have.
Almost a quarter of a century. We've been together for, we've been married since 2010, but we've been together since 2001. It's 2024, so we've been together for 24 years.
Oh my goodness, yeah, a quarter of a century.
Yeah. That's great.
That's crazy.
Yeah, long time.
That's awesome. No, it's awesome.
I remember even when we had our first date, or like when we first met, when we started, you know, when we officially became boyfriend girlfriend, you don't even know those dates. I know those dates.
I'm not good with dates.
You're not.
Dates.
Anyways, all right. So some clarification, because I've seen some patients, like you said, they're saying you don't need a pap smear for every like 5 years or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now it's if everything comes back clean and you're, you know, in a relationship where you
a committed monogamous relationship, you're not having many sexual partners. You have one, then the I guess my main question is to clarify the value of having annual pap smear and a speculum exam. There's really not a lot of value to that, is there?
Yeah, now they're even saying with postmenopausal women, you don't need to have one again, ever again. Like you just don't have to have it.
That's
my point.
Of course,
if you had we have a lot of patients that are postmenopausal and they might have a new partner. So then, yes, let's check those cells.
Now, a way to change that which I think it should be, instead of doing the pap smear and the speculum exam, they just need to have a transvaginal ultrasound every year.
Oh, I think that would be great. Yeah, yeah. No, that's like easy. Like I said, it's not invasive. And then for somebody like Sheila that might be wondering, is there a lining thickened in my uterus, but I don't know about it, it would give us all the information. So
yeah, and it gives peace of mind both to the practitioner and it gives peace of mind to the patient that they're not harming themselves in some way, because it's the silent growth of that lining that's what nobody wants. Mm-hmm. That's what you and I don't want. That's what they don't want. And that's what turns into a problem. So I just had a thought and I just lost it. I'll come back to it. I've heard a few women say, which I sort of agree with myself, that there's just not going through that rote routine every year of having a pap smear when you're in your 50s or 60s. It doesn't really provide a lot of information, but most patients don't realize the information that it actually, they think that having a pap smear and an annual exam actually does look at their uterus, and it really doesn't.
No, it doesn't do. I mean,
at least the communication that I got from some of my patients recently, I think they were under the impression that, oh, I had my annual, everything's good down there.
Well, and sometimes when you take the cells on that cervix, it'll say like there's some endometrial cells because they're not, of course, if someone's having a period, when they're getting their pap smeared, there's going to be endometrial cells. But you can sometimes catch that where it'll say like endometrial cells shown on da 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 da, and then you know that probably want to do a transvaginal ultrasound. But I think it's a better idea just to do the transvaginal ultrasound. And it is changing. You know, a lot of gynecologists are saying, you know, what your postmenopausal, there's no reason to do another pap smear.
Cervical cancer risk is going to be really low. Yeah. Like it's going to be really, really low. Like why would you need to do that?
But like you said, doing a transvaginal ultrasound would give a lot of information.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So speaking of that, right, because that's what we're talking about at the end of the day. So what are the guidelines, like the radiological guidelines, when they do a transvaginal ultrasound, what's the guidelines for that?
What do you say?
What are they looking for? If they're looking for suspected, you know, thickened lining.
So what are you looking for? What am I looking for when we read a transvaginal ultrasound?
Yeah, sure. No, I'm asking you that question.
Yeah, so you're looking for a thickening of the uterine lining, like we've already talked about, and that would be anything really, you know, anything under 5 millimeters is considered pretty much normal.
Five millimeters. So we're not talking a very.
No, it's not. You want it thin. Like you don't want a centimeter or anything like that. Like you want it thin. And then also too, looking for fibroids. Sometimes HRT, if you're on too much estrogen, it'll stimulate the fibroids. I haven't really seen it stimulate too much endometriosis, at least in my practice, but I'm sure that there is that possibility.
Even with rhythmic dosing, we haven't seen a lot of that.
I really have not. You know, looking for cysts on the ovaries, looking for cysts, looking for the complex cysts.
Polyps.
Follicular cysts.
Yeah.
Yeah, polyps.
I have a patient right now that's dealing with actually a couple of them that that know that they have some polyps. One of them said her insurance. One of them said that, which I thought was interesting, that the polyp was to deal with the polyp, which would you do a DNC, right? That it was not considered medically necessary to deal with that polyp. What do you think about that?
Wow. I mean, polyps are not cancerous. They are never going to be cancerous. Mm-hmm. Now, they could cover up a little bit of some architecture that could be, you know, potentially, but that's probably not really the case.
You just said that. That's a good statement. So a uterine polyp will never turn into cancer.
Never. Mm-hmm. Okay. Never. But it's annoying. It causes spotting, you know. It can cause spotting, an annoying spotting, like after intercourse, after exercise, after a bowel movement. It's annoying.
Sure. Yeah. Those are, like I said, this is important stuff because, you know, that's why hormones relatively, if you do it right, you get the benefit without any of the risk.
But I would say with the polyp, I mean, go and do a DNC. I mean, I know there's people, you know, insurance, you can pay out of pocket. There's discounts if you pay out of pocket, but yeah, go and do a DNC. It removes the polyps, and some people, polyps run in their family. It's a little bit genetic, and then you can work on things to keep that lining thin so the polyps don't, you know, come back.
So we threw in about three separate things into that one question. So you want to read one of the next ones,
sure.
Just to get a little bit more verbiage there, and we'll kind of keep going through the.
This is a good one because the questions we're going to say on here actually kind of come together. So we were talking about how do you know if you have a thickened lining with static dosing, you know, from Sheila. So this one is from Heavenly Pick. And she said, she's so confused. That's why I really wanted to do this one. I'm so confused. Dr. Mackey said, we don't ever put estradiol on the vaginal tissue. I am prescribed an estradiol cream to use vaginally, and I believe many, many other women, this is true, many other women out there use estradiol cream for the vagina. I've listened to many other doctors' podcasts who prescribe estradiol for the vagina. Here, he is the only doctor who has ever said, don't use it on the vaginal tissue because it causes growth of the tissues. Why is it so contradicting between all the doctors? I am so confused.
Yeah, no, great question.
Mm-hmm. It is.
You and I will say, and just to reiterate, you and I are a little bit different. We are different in our approach when it comes to that. She's totally right. And I can see why, which is exactly why we're doing the podcast, is because it is so contradictory and there's information. There's difference of opinions when it comes to specifically hormone. You know, you got high blood pressure, you got high cholesterol. There's a protocol to follow. There's this drug, that drug, a couple of other ones. Everyone ends up doing the same thing. There's three or four different medications that get prescribed, and that's it. Right? There's a standard
in the conventional.
Yeah. There's a standard of care for all those things. Hormone replacement, there is no standard of care. No one's established it. And this is not because women are complicated, but hormonally, there's a lot of complexity. And the individuality of one woman to the next, there'll never be a standard of care when it comes to hormone replacement, unless we have something to say about that. Because I think that, you know, I like the way we do things. And I think that it can be established that there are some, a starting point for most women. So we are meant to be contradictory on purpose, because just in our experience, we've been doing this for, literally 21 years. And 22 years, right? So we've been in practice a long time. We have just seen that using estradiol sometimes can cause some problems.
Well, I think the reason, I mean, this is a great question. I think the reason this is, and I do believe estradiol is going to be prescribed for the uterine, you know, the vaginal tissues, because estradiol does not thicken up the uterine lining. There's something about it stimulates a different type of receptor in the uterus that estradiol does. But the reason that estradiol has always been, even Premarin, which is not even an estradiol, that's a equine estrogen, that was used vaginally. Nobody ever does that anymore. This is all going to change. But the reason why the estradiol is used vaginally is because that is what has been available all this time,
especially commercially
from these big box pharmacies. So you can go and see any doctor that's willing to prescribe it will be like, before it was, oh, let me write you some Premarin cream. And now we know that's just gross. And truly it is. It is. And then now we also know that, you know, they can go into a doctor and say, you know, I'm having vaginal dryness, which is a huge issue when it comes to menopause, especially post-menopause.
Oh, yeah.
Is vaginal dryness is inevitable for, you know, most women after menopause. I can go into a few aspects that don't, but that's a whole nother podcast and it's really interesting. But that's what they have available. I will write you a prescription for it. You go down to your big box pharmacy on the corner, which is probably 25 feet away, and they go pick it up. But they don't realize there are better options. Estradiol, you can't go down to your big box pharmacy, at least at this moment right now in this country that we're in. I know in other countries in Europe you can, and get estradiol for the vaginal tissues. So that's why it's just not as available. So when she's confused, I can understand that, because estradiol is not really that widely available. But I have had patients that have not been, who are postmenopausal, their ovaries have retired, and they are using vaginal estradiol, E2, and when I do their blood work, it shows up in their blood. So,
or they get bleeding from it, one of the two.
There it does show up in the blood, so it is going systemic. And I've looked this up, you know, on different websites and looked this up. And a lot of times they'll say, and even the companies that make these estradiol vaginally, because there are companies that do that, and they'll say, oh yeah, there's a minor, what was I reading on one, this was a while back, there's a minor blood increase in estradiol levels, but it's inconsequential. Is it?
Sheila said earlier, how do you know if the uterine lining is building up? If you're applying something vaginally, which is so close to your uterus, but you don't bleed from it because it's not quite enough stimulation, but now that uterine lining, now at some point, to that point, if you're using it on a regular basis, eventually you're going to start bleeding, more than likely. The worst case scenario is you're using something vaginally and you don't bleed, but the lining is still growing. That is a terrible situation. So that's why, Heavenly, looks like Pickler, she must make pickles. She must like some good pickles. That's why she's so confused, because we choose to take the more cautious safer route, which is using estradiol. Estradiol still can still contribute to that a little bit, sort of. You got to be careful.
Wait, back up again. What did you say? I was thinking about pickles. Sorry.
Yeah. Using estriol is the sort of weaker hormone that is going to spare the uterine lining. But I've still had patients use it and they bleed from it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've had a few. So it is using the, you know, kind of the lesser of several evils. So that's why, as a rule, you and I have always used, and we were very staunch about that, we've used estriol only because it still solves the problem just as good, if not better. You don't have the consequence or the side effect that you would with the estradiol.
And I will say, when I've used estriol for vaginal atrophy, vaginal dryness, and on women that aren't on any hormone replacement, that's all we're working on is just vaginal atrophy, yeah. Nothing else systemic. And I do blood work on their estradiol. It does not show up in the blood. It does not convert.
Estriol.
No, the estradiol, like, it doesn't change.
Oh, the blood level.
Yeah, the blood levels.
Yeah,
and
right.
One thing is, like I said, those companies, I've looked at their websites, I've read their stuff, and they say, oh, it's inconsequential. But when I'm doing any kind of hormone replacement with a patient, I want to know exactly what dose they're on and what their blood levels show up. It's not that it, maybe I'm just really particular about that. Like your patient you were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. I don't want an estradiol level at 270.
God, not on the static dose. You can do that on a rhythmic dose, which we'll talk about later, but you cannot have a level of, I had another one, and I know you have these all the time too, but I just remember those numbers. Hers was 117. Mm-hmm. She had been on the patch. She wasn't doing very well on the patch. But she was better because they raised the dosage of the patch. Her blood level was 117. I said, you're going to get a period in the next month. 3 days later, she got a period, right? Because it cannot be that high. We're on a static dose.
You're like the period psychic.
Oh, no. You know it better than I do. Mm-hmm. I've learned it all from you, that those things. Now, the good part about those scenarios is that they actually do bleed, mm-hmm. right? It gives us information to be able to adjust and adjust and modify so they don't continue to bleed. It's the ones that there is no bleeding that the ones you have to be careful with. You know, that's where the yearly transvaginal ultrasound comes in. So women, you know, I don't know if it's a bold statement or not, no pap smear, no, you know, speculum exam, just get a transvaginal ultrasound. You're good to go.
Yeah. So
you can do all three if you want, but if you're going to do any of those things, get the transvaginal ultrasound and then make sure your lining is nice and thick. If you're on either a vaginal cream of any sort or any kind of systemic hormone, that way you have, you know, some peace of mind that you're not harming yourself without even realizing.
Yeah. No, like I said, it's really easy to do. And that's why I liked this question from Heavenly Pickler that, if you have the option, use the estriol. If you have the option, use the estriol.
Yeah.
I really feel like that's a good idea.
Unfortunately, it's not covered by insurance probably in most places or most insurance policies. But I think that
it's not very expensive.
No,
The price on that, I mean, it costs less than that darn shampoo and stuff I have to buy from
your cosmetics, Jesus.
You use them too.
Use
my hair shampoo.
Well, I got to wash my hair.
Well, you got gray hair.
I got to wash my hair.
Amazing hair.
I got to wash my hair. The thing I was surprised about is that hairspray. Jesus, your hairspray is really expensive.
Very clean hairspray. So yeah, all that stuff for us gals, you know, that are like trying to cover up the silvers, estriol costs less than that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and there's lots of places to get estriol. I mean, estriol is, that is honestly.
Nowadays, not even 5 years ago wasn't as available, but it's changing.
The secret is sort of out. I mean,
out.
I mean, as you and I have been doing hormones for all these years, estriol is the secret. Mm-hmm. That's the part that, you know, when it comes to, you know, the vaginal issues that, and women are realizing too, you can use it on your face. So you get two for the price of one,
which I have planned another podcast about that. Cause we got a lot of comments about, estriol on your face, estradiol on your face, melasma, hyperpigmentation,
that's our next episode.
So I've already got some other comments. So I know people might be looking at this thinking, well, what about my comment? Don't worry. I got him. we'll get to him.
Just to summarize Heavenly's question, I can understand why she's confused. Mm-hmm. That's exactly why we're doing the podcast. That's exactly why we're talking about her question, because it is very confusing, right? It's confusing for practitioners. It's confusing for patients. At the end of the day, you know, hormones are great, but you still need to be safe with them. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's really what these questions are about, is that long-term safety. Because, you know, if a woman's in her, let's say, you know, when would you... this is just a range, you know, right? When would you expect a woman age-wise to start experiencing some vaginal issues?
Dryness, pain with
intercourse, you know, those things that tend to happen. What age would she be?
honestly, of course, that happens when that estrogen drops. So that would be kind of right before menopause, definitely in menopause, definitely post-menopause. I've had some women in their 40s and perimenopause actually have some vaginal dryness, and we've worked on it with the estriol.
So give me a range of where it starts. I can't tell you a year.
Definitively. I mean, I can only,
38, 42?
No, not 38. I mean, no.
I've had some that way. Really? And you have two.
Yeah, but not enough to say that's, you know, something that's common. I would say.
Give me an age.
I would say more
on
like
average.
Probably depending on their hormones, if their estrogen has dropped. I can't really answer that. Gosh, I feel bad.
45 and beyond.
Perhaps, but I have lots of women, like I was saying earlier, I have women that are postmenopausal, not on any hormones, and they have no trouble with lubrication.
Oh yeah, but those are the exceptions to the rule, right?
That's why I feel like it really depends on the person.
Well, I'm trying to get you give me a specific answer, and you're hedging around it.
I can't.
Maybe
I don't understand the question.
collectively, what is the average age that women start to complain about dryness, pain, where you would want to prescribe them
some estriol? I would say the majority would be like 51.
I think it's earlier than that. I think it's the late 40s.
For vaginal dryness from, you know, lack of estrogen, that, you know, I've had lots of women that have maybe some issues with, you know, I do a lot with libido through all ages, you know, maybe some vaginal irritation, you know, there's that. But I would say in terms of like, you know, low estrogen equals vaginal atrophy, I'd say in the early 50s. Or when they go into menopause.
I think it's earlier. I think it's
everything's
earlier.
Different. Everybody's
I
different.
I think it's earlier. I mean, on average, statistically, if we looked at everyone, you know, so you're right, it's going to be probably, you know, 49 to 51, somewhere in that narrow range. But I think it expands a little bit before.
And then a lot of couples, you know, they use lubricants and vaginal moisturizers, vaginal lubricants. I mean, just.
But some of those, if they're having like a real lack of estrogen issue, some things don't really help all that much.
But the estriol is, you know, safe for women of all ages. I think that's what's so interesting, actually, to go back to Heavenly mm-hmm. Pickler's question is, you know, I would hope that a doctor would be very hesitant to give like a 38-year-old estrodiol to use for vaginal dryness.
Right. And that's like why we're talking about this.
That would not be good to do that. I can, you know, like I said, even postmenopausal isn't great either, but, you know, you wouldn't want to give a cycling woman more estrogen on top of estrogen, but you could do estriol just because it is so much more gentle.
And you'd want to be a little bit more, a little bit more careful with the frequency of it, right?
You
can't, anything, even the estriol, you can't use it every day. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't use it every day, you know, on a long-term basis. Oh, so here's
the estriol. Wait, but can you say that again?
Here's another case. A patient of mine, I've known her for years. She just had sort of I'm trying to remember now. She had a bladder prolapse.
Yeah.
Okay. I think I just answered my own question, but her surgeon wants her to use her estriol cream. She'd already on estriol cream, right? Her surgeon she wanted me to adjust the dose because her surgeon wants her to use it every day. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, if I remember correctly, I think
and this is estriol, not estradiol.
Oh, well, I had prescribed estriol. Mm-hmm. He wasn't prescribing anything. He just said take it every day because it's because of the problem. He agreed that that's a good idea. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you and I only prescribe. We don't make exceptions about that. We don't have any patient that we prescribe estradiol vaginally for, not one. Okay? We are very clear about that. That's why we're answering the question because sounds like we're the only ones that do that, right? Everyone else goes the other way. And
just because estradiol is more common. So you answered your own question. I want to hear
There's some more details there that are not. So he said for her to use it every day. With a woman with a uterus, can she still use estriol every day vaginally?
I've had women use it multiple times a week, up to five times a week.
I said every day.
Yes, I think they could.
Mm-hmm. Every day forever.
Yeah.
And she's in her 70s.
I believe so. I actually do that for women with urinary incontinence. It's amazing for tonifying the urethra to help with, you know, a little urinary leakage, which is common, you know, common for a lot of us ladies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would have thought you would have said maybe not.
It's one of those things that the women, they don't really always want to use it every day because it's just enough to, it's like one more thing to do in your
That's not the question. It's not that it's inconvenient. Is it safe to do that? That's my question.
Yes. Yeah, estriol, not estradiol, but estriol. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I would have thought you would have said something different.
I think estriol is very safe for the vaginal tissues in the uterus. Now, granted, you don't want to just get a bunch of estriol and go off for the rest of your life and put it on. You still want to communicate with somebody that's going to be monitoring
and
that
the
for you.
And the dosing of that would matter mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah.
So if you were going to use that, so we have a typical dose range, what dose long-term, let's say hypothetically, they did have some incontinence, it helps them have more control. What daily application dose would you be comfortable with?
Now, doing urinary incontinence is completely different than working with the vaginal atrophy. Sure. It helps. So I would say I always do a lot higher. Like I'll even go up to 5 or 10 milligrams of estriol with a woman with pretty good vaginal or having urinary incontinence. And there are some studies where I know this is so weird and I don't know why this works, but if you combine vitamin D, just take vitamin D every day, and you're taking vitamin D and you're using an estriol at a good dose, 5 to 10 milligrams, sometimes up to 12 milligrams, that it has
estriol
that has significant effect on the urinary incontinence. Mm-hmm. And a lot of women, when they have the urinary incontinence, they doing less than 5 doesn't have, it can help a little bit, but some of the really severe urinary incontinence, you have to go at least 5 milligrams.
Oh, that's interesting. Now I just learned something.
I might do like 2.5 up to 5. There's a few that I've had around 10 to 12, but it's not forever. So it might be for a little while, and we'll do it up to five days a week.
Okay, slow down now. What do you mean not forever? What does that mean?
Well, that's what happens.
Because I know I'm you're answering my question now. So there is a transition period there of how you do those.
Yeah,
so
I might, and same with vaginal atrophy, I might kind of load it up for every day for 7 days and then do it twice a week.
So that's my point. You can't do 12 milligrams every day forever.
Well, for urinary incontinence, you won't need to, because what you find is that urinary incontinence gets better.
Now you're answering my question. You're contradicting yourself now. There's a lot of clarification there.
Because I know you've had somebody with estriol bleed. I've never had anybody on estriol alone have a period or get uterine thickening. And that's just me. You know, I'm one practitioner with so many patients. That doesn't
mean
it doesn't
happen.
Well, and
I could be confusing. We've been doing this a long time. You're complicating this now a little bit, because it could be an exception on my part. All right. So let's stop talking in absolutes, because now you're saying it's never happened. And I think it's happened, but it's been 20 years with lots of people. So if you say it doesn't happen, to be honest, we're arguing about the same thing, because we both know that it's the safe route to go, which is exactly why we do it. Okay. At the end of the day, that's why we do it. And now you're just complicating with all this other stuff about, yes, you can do it, but you can't, and you've got to raise the dose.
But you were asking about urinary incontinence. With urinary incontinence, it works really good.
No, I totally get it. I totally get all that. But my point is that there's ways that you approach it. If you're using a lower dose, you can use it all the time. If you're using a higher dose, it's got to go through a transition period. Mm-hmm. So depending on the problem you're trying to solve, that's why that has to be a whole separate episode, mm-hmm. because
urinary incontinence is.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Because women don't want to go have surgeries or have bladder lifts and all that. I mean, if something can help like that, or even just lighten up a little the urinary incontinence so that someone can, you know,
They still have a run. They still have some control. Yeah, they're not having to wear a pad or anything like that.
For the bathroom when you got to go. Yeah.
Nobody wants to do that. So you're right. We're blending a few too many things in there. You know, so you're complicated to communicate with.
I'm complicated. We're complicated.
All right. Well, I think we beat that. We're not going to get to the third one.
Wait, I do want to.
Was there one more?
Yeah, there was one more that I.
The one from Catherine. That's the one you have highlighted on my sheet.
No, actually, it wasn't about that. But I just had to give a shout out to two people real quick. Good girl, I'm not sure, but anyway, so two people left these really great messages. First one was Natasha. I'm not sure if I'm saying it right. Mona Laveau, sorry. She said, thank you so much for not only caring for humans' health, but also caring for the animals and their well-being. So Vivi's down here. You can't see her, Vivian, but I know she must have seen Vivian
We
must have talked about her, but I thought that was really sweet. And also to Good Girl Wagun, she said Vivian is the producer.
She's the girl behind the scenes.
So yeah, I just had to give a shout out to that, because I thought that was really sweet. Because we always bring the dogs to the video room here. And
Bob's over there
panting
at the door trying to get out, panting. And then she's always at our feet.
Wanting to get pet.
Usually nudging your arm so you'll actually pet her. You know, so
I just wanted to talk about that.
Yeah. Now, granted, there's a bunch there that we need to rehash, but see, that's why these things, she's confused. She's listening to us. I made a bold statement. It made her even more confused. I hope we clarify that a little bit, because this, I really do think, or we both think that that's why we're talking about it, because that's a really important issue. Okay. And yeah. We make no exceptions. It is estriol only. I've had few women say, well, can I just use estradiol? And that's what my other doctor, nope, you can go back to them and they can prescribe it for you. We will not prescribe you estradiol to use on your vagina.
Especially when you can get such good results with the estriol.
And you can get just as good results without any of the risk. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, it's worth it. Even if you have to pay out of pocket for it, it is worth the peace of mind that you are doing something safe. Because if you're a woman's in her 40s and 50s and you're going to be on hormones for 20 years, mm-hmm. You want to make sure that you're doing something that's going to be safe enough for you to do for 20 years. All right. That's why we're very adamant about the using estriol only. And every compounding pharmacy, that's why it's sort of the secret, every compounding pharmacy has a vaginal estriol that they create for doctors.
And honestly, I haven't looked into it, so I can't give too much information, but I've been finding that it's on the internet. There's different online places you can buy it from without a prescription, I've heard. So I haven't looked at it.
If you're buying without a prescription, I would be very careful with that.
Yeah, so I can't speak to that.
But I'm not even sure how that's, I would be buying it from a really good compounding pharmacy. You're putting it on a mucous membrane. You're putting it on your vagina. You want to know where that's coming from. And that's where you need a regulation, because that just doesn't seem right to me.
But like I was saying, can't speak to that, but it's all, it's coming forth. So it's different than before. So Heavenly Pickler, I do feel like estriol is on the rise.
Yeah. You heard it here first. I think we've answered all those questions, or at least that one big one. Honestly, that question's going to come. It's already come up a bunch. It's going to come up a bunch more times. We don't mean to repeat ourselves. Every one of these episodes is a little bit different, and it kind of morphs into a bunch of different topics and ideas. Feel free to write your comments down below. That's what we're going to start transitioning to. We're going to start answering and reading more of those comments, because that's the whole reason why we started the channel in the first place, is to have this interaction back and forth. So please leave your comments and pay attention for the next episodes. This is actually a lot of fun. I enjoy arguing with you. Do you enjoy arguing?
I didn't feel like we were arguing.
Oh, of course not. Of course not.
Argue.
Yeah. We'll turn the camera off. We're not arguing. We're just having a very passionate, very professional conversation.
Absolutely.
And you're really cute to argue with.
Thanks.
All right. Until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
I'm Dr. Davidson.
Take care. Bye-bye.